If you want to turn to Acts chapter 17, our first reading will be from Acts 17 here in just a moment. I know that on the minds of many right now, there's much evil and much sorrow that has gone on in our nation over the last 3 to 4 weeks, starting with the tragedy in Buffalo and then the tragedy in Texas and even other smaller, perhaps, incidents that have crossed your mind that aren't and maybe in the minds of everyone else here to where there may be a great weight weighing on us. And I thought about the types of sermons that have been going on lately. Some of them were going on Sunday nights. We're not all here on Sunday nights. And so what I wanted to do is kind of redirect our attention towards some things we're working on Sunday nights that may be helpful for someone that's gathered here this morning. But it may also be something that helps equip us for talking to other people about their perceptions about Christianity. And so on Sunday nights, we've had a couple of lessons on evidences, we might just say. Might be the way you label it. Here we give evidence for the reasons we believe. Not only that Jesus was a real man, a real historical figure, but the reasons we believe that the best explanation for the empty tomb, or we might skip to the millions of people who claim to be followers, the best explanation for these millions of followers is the tomb was really empty, as even the skeptics acknowledged whenever they began to spread the story that said, well, the guards fell asleep. And so we talked in the past on some of our Sunday night lessons about how Christianity is based on strong evidences and reasons. And that's really been maybe my main attack or my main angle of argumentation when trying to reason with people about Christianity. But you know, there's other reasons that people object to Christianity. And one of the reasons that people object to Christianity is heavily on the hearts and minds of many Americans right now. It's an emotional reaction of, and I don't mean emotional in a negative way. I don't mean it at that at all. It's a very real, that needs to be acknowledged and affirmed feeling that says, this world is messed up. And that cries out at times, where is God? Why didn't he stop this? My family had the opportunity this weekend to make a journey I never imagined I would make. I remember a long time ago when I was a kid in high school and the tragedy that first kind of woke America up to the fact that this is not the first time, but this one woke them up for various reasons, Columbine High School. And so we were up there yesterday and Lauren and I went over to the memorial without our children and wept. And I turned to her and I said, the kids need to come see this. And I was struck by how much, and I had forgotten that how much this played a role in it, how much there were Christian statements from those children and those families. I think there were 13 plaques there, 12 children and one teacher. For some reason, I couldn't tell which one the teacher was. But of the 13 plaques where the families had chosen what was going to be on their memorial plaque at that memorial, over 8 of them mentioned Jesus and faith that we believe in here. And as you know, one of them, of course, their last words being that, you know, I believe, before that teenager's life was taken. And so there's rational reasons that we need to wrestle with some people. Hey, why don't you believe in Christianity? There's also emotional reasons that people need to address. Again, not a negative thing, but acknowledge that, affirm that, that yes, there's a lot of grief, there's a lot of sorrow, there's been a lot of hurts done that make it hard sometimes to believe in a God. And to believe that Jesus is the answer. It was a song we sang about in Christ alone and letting his light shine on us. And so I'll acknowledge to you the one that is going to make it into this morning's sermon, I don't know which camp it fits in. Is it an emotional objection or is it a rational objection? It's an objection, I can say this to you. I've not really ever spent much time on it before. As I told you all, when I go through these evidences lessons, I'm grabbing other people's books to see what objections they've heard and what objections they've tried to answer. And I grabbed this guy's book, and one of the first ones he addresses is one that I don't think I would have ever thought to address, except for the fact that he spent a section addressing it. He said one of the reasons he's heard people object to Christianity is because they say, that's an old and dying religion. I don't think I would have ever thought to address this. But I decided here's what I want to do. I want to address this one as an invitation to all of us to recognize that there are ways to be able to reason with people and be able to affirm their emotions and talk to people about Christianity. And so I acknowledge this may be an awkward sermon title, even an awkward maybe Sunday morning lesson. It's an advertisement that you'll
If you don't join us on Sunday nights, you at least use our website to look at the Sunday night sermons. They're going to be filtered, easy to find. Lessons on evidences and the Bible and science are included in some of these evidences, because I love to talk about how Bible and science go together. They're not at war with one another, and so we'll say some more about that here in this morning's lesson. I was actually, as I had this PowerPoint prepared around the house, as my laptop traveled from the kitchen table to the dining room table to the living room couch, I kept worrying if I left this screen open, my kids would be wondering, what in the world is Daddy looking at? Is Christianity old and dying? That sounds like a terrible sermon title. I'm going to answer for you, obviously, if you're gathered here, you're not going to be surprised at this. No, it's not dying, but it is old. I think there's a way that we can use that in our advantage. And so some of you maybe have seen headlines like this one. Christianity continues to decline among U.S. adults. This one on the right, Southern Baptists dropped 1.1 million members in 3 years. Church membership in the U.S. has fallen below the majority for the first time in nearly a century. It seems like headline after headline is people being worried about the changing stats of Christianity in America. This is nothing new. I remember a deacon many years ago in Atlanta bringing me, are you worried about this latest Pew report? Can't even say that word, Pew report. If you aren't familiar with Pew, that's where a lot of these times, these studies come from this, the Pew Research Foundation. They're a nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank that looks at a lot of demographics in America. They don't look at just at religion, but they are considered one of the experts on religion in America. And notice here, I think that's an important part. This religious landscape studies, you can read, if you could read the small print, if it says it surveys more than 35,000 Americans from all 50 states about their religious affiliations, beliefs, and practices, and social and political views. It's a very helpful think tank for data. So if you're into trying to find out about what's the story behind these headlines, I would encourage you to go there, because as we all know, data can be what? Manipulated. And so sometimes the headlines might be looking more negative than they really are. You can find some positive stuff in the Pew Research Forum. Sometimes that might be our side manipulating them some in our favor, to be honest and fair about that. But I would encourage you, it's interesting data, but here's something I would encourage you to think about right off the bat with this whole argument of, is it old and dying? Is look at Acts chapter 17, Acts chapter 17, beginning in verse 16. It says, now while Paul was waiting for them in Athens, his spirit was provoked within him as he saw that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in a synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons and in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. See, there's a place for reasoning, okay? Some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers also conversed with him. And some said, what does this babbler wish to say? Others said, he seems to be a preacher of foreign divinities because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection. And they took him and brought him to the Areopagus, saying, may we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? That would have been the common place in that time for debating public theories and ideas and whatnot. I guess since people have been calling Twitter the new public forum, I guess the Twitter of the ancient world maybe. I don't know about all that, but that's what our culture sometimes says. May we know about this teaching, for you bring some strange things to our ears. We wish to know, therefore, what these things mean. Now all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there would spend their time in nothing except telling or hearing something new. This is an age-old issue that humanity deals with. We want to hear something new. We want a new idea. We want a new theory. We want a fresh approach. And sometimes people want some kind of new idea to believe in. They wouldn't want to call it religion. Maybe they'll say this, I'm not religion. I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual. Okay, they want a new spiritual idea, a new religious idea, whatever word you want to call it. They want this new thing to put their identity in, their hopes in, their future in, and it's nothing new. People have had this attitude from long ago. And so here's one of the things that I want to spin this in our favor is to say this. You know, sometimes some of these people who become very open-minded, they're willing to entertain anything. You know what they're willing to entertain too, if you'll give it a chance with them? Primitive Christianity. This has been going on for decades. I've had friends that are on the West Coast, and I say this as a compliment to the West Coast. My wife and I have had a great relationship with Christians on the West Coast. We love people from California. We've been going to California almost annually most of our married life. It started before we even got married when I was invited to come out to speak at this church in California, and I experienced there, don't tell any of the Southerners who might be visiting, you guys in the back, block her ears. Don't tell any of the Southerners visiting or any ones if you travel back that way that I said this, but the Californians put the Southerners to shame with their hospitality while I was out there. There was this little town home, and at the end of the gospel meeting, there was 200 people at this gospel meeting. The preacher stood in front of all 200 and said, "You're all invited to my house for an ice cream social after the gospel meeting." And I thought to myself, well, how are we all going to fit? And what I didn't realize is that unlike the South, where it's hot and humid all the time, and if you put ice cream out there, it'll be melted in 5 seconds. In California, the weather's perfect all the time. And so what he'd done, he put 2 pop-up tents out in the backyard. And so there was about less than 100 in the house and less than 100 in the backyard. Not everybody came, but it was wonderful. And I said, man, I can't imagine any of the Martha Stewarts back in Alabama or Georgia inviting 200 people into their little, you know, 1,100 square foot space. There's been wonderful Christians I've known from the West Coast, and as I went out there, I would notice trends on the West Coast were a little bit ahead of what was going on in the rest of America. And I talked to one preacher about this. I said, do you find it harder out here in the West Coast to preach the gospel? He goes, I find it easier than it is in the South. He'd been in both places. I said, what do you mean it's easier in California than it is in the South? He goes, in California, they're open-minded. And he goes, and a lot of my cynical brethren like to say they're so open-minded their brains are going to fall out. But instead, I say the open-mindedness gives me an opportunity to preach to them the old-fashioned gospel of Jesus Christ. Something some of them had never heard. Whereas my friends in the South, they ignore me and say, oh, I've heard this already. They think they know the gospel, and they haven't actually taken time to investigate it. So, yeah, people want to hear something new. But keep this in mind. The old story might be new to some of these people. So don't be afraid to tell it. Here Paul is going to the debate center of his day with an idea that he knew they were going to say, well, this is strange and weird. I don't know about this, Paul. And he said, I'm not worried about how strange or weird you think I am. I need to tell you what God has told me is true and what you need to hear. And so may we be bold enough to preach like Paul about this supposedly old and dying religion. So here's how we would answer, how I would answer, and many others would answer, this idea of is Christianity in decline? Let's do the decline first, then we'll come back to the old. Is it Christianity in decline? Well, I think our impressions depend on our location and our age. Where do you live and what demographic are you? This particular book I was reading, he talked about what coast are you on. He was an academic professor, and his experience had been that if you're on the West Coast or East Coast, there's more skepticism than if you're in the heart of America. Maybe that's true, maybe it's not. Pew Research data maybe can bear that out. Again, that may be manipulation of the data. But what is true is, depending on where you go in the world, you're going to get a different taste of this. In 1900, in sub-Saharan Africa, 10% claimed to be Christians. You want to know how many claim to be Christians in 2000 in sub-Saharan Africa? Over 50%. So in the 100 years we've been living here in America, and things seem to have gone downhill, in sub-Saharan Africa, they're going uphill for the Christians, at least. You may say, well, can I ask you about these other issues? No, I'm not an expert to know how their economy's doing, or how their transportation system is doing, or how their healthcare is doing. What I know is the number of Christians is growing in some places. It's not just sub-Saharan Africa. That's the one I had data on. But I've also seen data in the past on Asia, and some of the third world countries where people are more impoverished and they're more destitute. And what some argue is Americans and their wealth have wrongly concluded, I guess I don't need God, I got everything I need. Whereas the countries where they're more destitute, they're saying, I need something else to believe in. And so depending on where you live, you might be saying, yeah, man, Christianity is dying out. My professor friend that I was reading his book about was, if he has always been going to mainstream denominations in America, yes, 2 decades ago, you might have gone down to First United Methodist or First Presbyterian or First Lutheran, whatever, and you might have seen 500 people there on a Sunday. And in those mainline denominations, they're on the decline in those cities. So if he's revisited recently, he might see, yeah, man, you just have 500 and now you're barely getting 50 on a Sunday. But some of the more conservative groups, even, yes, here in America, in those last 20 years, they have seen an increase in membership and attendance, while the mainline ones have seen a decrease. So again, it's on where you live, country-wise. Also, where are you attending? to see your numbers? What age are you? That's another demographic. Younger people, the numbers aren't looking as good. But when is it that a lot of people have seen their conversions? I mean, we got some stories right here to acknowledge. Yeah, when I was in my 20s, my attendance was terrible. But when I had blank, fill it in. When I hit bankruptcy, when I hit divorce, let's be a little more positive. Those are negative. When I had kids, when I got married, some of you spouses were drugged to church by your spouse, right? And you're thankful for that, right? And so, yeah, 20-year-olds, a lot of them, they're like, yeah, I'm not religious. Yeah, that's one of the headlines I see a lot of time, the rise of the nuns. And that's not talking about there's a lot more Catholic ladies, you know, dressing up that way. The nuns is N-O-N-E, that there's more and more people saying, I'm none of the above. I'm not Christian, I'm not Muslim, I'm not Jew, I'm not Islamic, I'm not, or maybe I'm not any of the denominations. Well, that's natural in the 20s, but what happens is a lot of people in their 30s, they begin to start looking around and saying, well, wait a second, I need something else in my life because something's missing, and they find it at church. So if you're young and in a very non-religious-minded city in this country, you probably do look alone. You probably do feel alone. Looking around and wondering, am I the only person that has these convictions? And so that's something to keep in mind. I want to turn back to this story. We've known this, a lot of y'all have known this story since you were a kid. In 2 Kings chapter 6, it has a little bit of humor to it, but it's also a good reminder of what the reality is in our world still today. In 2 Kings chapter 6, beginning verse 8, it says, once when the king of Syria was warring against Israel, he took counsel with his servants, saying, at such and such a place shall be my camp. But the man of God sent word to the king of Israel, be ready that you not pass this place, for the Syrians are going down there. And the king of Israel sent to the place about which the man of God told him. Thus he used to warn him so that he saved himself there more than once or twice. What's going on here again, if you can't tell what's going on? The man of God, here talking about Elisha, he has supernatural, God-given insight to know, okay, don't go there, that's where the king is. Oh, the king's moved, don't go there. So he's avoiding him. So the mind of the king of Syria was greatly troubled because of this thing, and he called his servants and said to them, will you not show me who of us is for the king of Israel? He thinks he has a mole within the operation. He thinks someone's out there telling the king of Israel where not to go. So he was like, which one of you guys is telling them where we're going? And one of his servants said, none, my lord, O king, but Elisha the prophet, who is in Israel, tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in his bedroom. And he said, go and see where he is, that I may send and seize him. That's a real interesting idea, right? The guy who keeps outsmarting you. Someone go kidnap him for me. It was told him, behold, he's in Dothan. So he sent there horses and chariots and a great army, and they came by night and surrounded the city. When the servant of the man of God rose early in the morning and went out, behold, an army with horses and chariots was all around the city. Oh, it looks like it might have worked, right? And the servant said there, alas, my master, this is Elisha's servant, alas, my master, what shall we do? He said, do not be afraid, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them. And then Elisha prayed and said, O Lord, please open his eyes that he may see. So Yahweh opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. And when the Syrians came down against him, Elisha prayed to Yahweh and said, please strike this people with blindness. So he struck them with blindness in accordance with the prayer of Elisha. We'll continue this story in a moment here, but you've known this since we were children. We've been taught this story in children's class as an inspirational message of what? When you feel alone, remember that there are more of God's people than you can ever see or imagine. And it's true. That's the message of what I'm trying to convey here. Again, if you're one of the people who is wondering, are we in decline? Be not discouraged. As Paul tells it to Timothy, the Lord knows who are his. The Lord knows how many people he has. We can never know. We will never know. And really, and you know, some of you may be saying, my answer would be, it doesn't really matter to me. Well, that's fine. If you have that kind of tough, tenacious spirit, you don't mind. I'll be the last one on earth, and I'm still going to stand for him. Good job, Peter. The point is here, there are more out there believing than you'll ever know. Now, one of the good things, we don't often talk about good things in social media. But one of the good things in social media, and I apologize, I have not yet sent you the video of your daughter. I need to do that. and y'all can choose what to do with it. You don't have to do this, but one of the things I love about social media is I'm seeing baptisms all the time on my Facebook page. There was a day and age in which you didn't know that people were being baptized. You might say, man, it's been a year since we've seen a baptism here. I see baptisms all the time on my Facebook page. Those are souls being added to the family of God. Those are horses and chariots of fire being added to the Lord's army. And so I feel surrounded by numbers of people because I'm in touch with spiritual things on my social media and trying to not let so much worldly stuff invade it. So be thoughtful about how you post and what you post. And know this, to the person who might say to you, man, Christianity's dying, say, man, you're following the wrong people. What do you mean? So, well, the people I'm with, they're talking about conversions all the time. As David and I were in the back last Sunday night, getting ready for him to immerse Dana into Christ, a guy from California texted me. He's been going through a lot of trouble. He's a midlife conversion. He was a scientist converted in his midlife. And he's now trying to study with his mom. And he and I have been praying together. And I've been giving him counsel about how to study with his mom, who's a skeptic. And he texted me. He said, I got good news. My mom agreed to study with me. We're going back down this week to study with her. I said, I've got good news. I'm helping a guy get ready to baptize his daughter. He texted me an hour later. He goes, we had a baptism out here tonight. Man, the Lord is alive. If you're not having those kind of moments in your life, get busy in the kingdom. And you'll see real quick that it's not in decline. In fact, there's so much work to be done. We need more people doing the work. It's just all about who you're surrounding yourself with. And what about how old it is? Well, young people, if you feel alone, give it some time, as we've been saying, and then recognize this. With how old it is, do you think it's really going to die? Death is rather unlikely for a religion that's been around this long. And throughout history, it has died in places, but it's also been revived. And so, when we're talking about the growth of Christianity in Africa just a moment ago, one of the things that I've been reading about is the reason it's growing in Africa is because sometimes the people are saying, well, I'm one of those ancient African religions. These are what the Africans are saying now. And the missionaries just say, well, you know how old Christianity is, right? No. And the right answer is, that's about where Christianity started. Acts chapter 8. The Ethiopian eunuch went home and he started teaching the gospel. And you don't ever get to hear this story as much. I can't. Someday I hope to get to teach church history. And I love to teach the Bible. I love textual lessons. And there's a time and place for all of that. There's also a time and place, I think, for topical lessons. And one of the topics I want to do is church history. And one of the things that I'm going to include in church history is something you don't get in a lot of church history books. I have two that are like this. Here's one, just one I brought into the pulpit as an example. How Africa shaped the Christian mind. And so if you've never heard this story, a lot of the great early thinkers of Christianity, anybody ever heard of Augustine? You know what his nationality was? African. Christianity is not a European medieval religion. And a lot of people want to bring attention to what happened in Europe in the medieval times. And that's just one small glimpse of a bad part, yes, of church history. But where church began was in the great places of Africa and spreading off into Asia long before it ever made it into Europe and way much longer before it ever made it into America. And while North America may be in decline, South America is one of those where, it's on the increase in South America, Christianity and its numbers. And so some of these converts are saying, well, I want to be a part of an African religion that goes back 2,000 years. Even in America, of those unaffiliated, you see here that 41% of them said religion is important. So when someone assumes that Christianity is old and dying, there's a couple of ways you could answer this. So in a sense, yeah, it's old. In fact, I'll call it even old-fashioned. And what is it that we say about some old-fashioned thing? How long did the old-fashioned refrigerators run? Yeah, some of them are still in your garage, aren't they? You're like, I've replaced the one in the kitchen 3 times now, but that one from the 1960s won't give out. Depending on how you see old-fashioned might mean more reliable. Yeah, go chase after these guys with PhDs and all their new theories, right? But you know a theory that's been around for 2,000 years and it didn't need a PhD to proclaim it was the gospel of Jesus Christ with a bunch of fishermen going out to the world and saying, hey, y'all need to believe in this carpenter. The one that God himself killed on the cross by the Romans? Yeah, that one. Because that's not the end of the good old story. God raised him from the dead. And he now gives new life to all of those who put their hopes in him. That's my answer to those who might say, well, isn't it old and dying? I'll tell you what, before we move on from this one, to move on to a second point here, second half of the lesson, not second point. I do think that what we might have also going on in America is an attendance issue or a commitment issue. Perhaps attendance at church and membership at church is dying out. And so let me then now step on our toes. We've been talking about how we talk to the people on the outside. Let's talk amongst ourselves and say this, even though it's hard. We might be the reason some aren't here. And you might rightfully say, well, not me. I'm too young. I haven't done anything yet. Okay, yeah. So older people might have done some things that ran some people off. So there's a lot of takeaways we can take from that. First of all, let's be willing to say, you know, I'm really sorry that the church hurts you that way. I'm sorry some people at church said that about you or said that stuff to you. Don't be dismissive of it. Don't act like it never happened. Embrace it. Take ownership of it. Acknowledge it. Affirm it and say, the church has done some terribly wicked, corrupt things. And if any of us thought back in the late 1990s or early 2000s that it was something just going on in the Roman Catholic churches, now we know loud and clear, if you're following the right people on Twitter, it's not just Roman Catholics, it's been Protestants too. And may God judge those who have been abusive to the little ones. And may God also judge those who protect them and hide them from the families and the little ones today. And let's not act like we're better than others. Let's acknowledge the hard pains, heart pains, that are going on in some people because when they were kids, church didn't treat them right. When they were spouses, elders didn't help protect them from verbal and physical abuse. There have been some scandals, not just in the European medieval church, but there have been scandals in God's church today. And maybe some of the reasons some say none and don't show up is because we haven't told them, I'm sorry, that was wrong, it should have never happened, please forgive me. And we need you back because we need those voices within God's people, to be able to speak up for the vulnerable victims that haven't been heard. And maybe then, when we create a culture that is a safe place to go, they'll be encouraged to come where they know they'll be loved and cared for and not swept away and dismissed. Because that's a scandal in its own right. Now, some of you may be saying, well, that's not my people. Those aren't the ones that I know about. The ones that I'm talking to, they're atheists, they're agnostics, they're academics. And like I said, there's lots of different angles of attack and argumentation you can and you probably should get into because everybody's unique. One of the lessons I want to do at some point is about knowing your audience. Paul makes it very clear in the book of Acts that based on his audience, he would change his tactics. And so some might say, well, how can we help those? I'm going to say to you that good attitudes can work wonders. Let's pick back up where we left off in 2 Kings chapter 6, verse 18. The Syrians came down against him. Elisha prayed to Yahweh and said, please strike this people with blindness. So he struck them with blindness in accordance with the prayer of Elisha. That's where we left off. And Elisha said to them, this is not the way, and this is not the city. Follow me, and I will bring you to the man whom you seek. And he led them to Samaria. I love that line. I got to tell y'all, all of Disney's writers and whoever helped with Star Wars, they were nothing original. They were copying the greatest story ever told. This is the way. This is not the city you seek. Follow me. So he led them to Samaria. And as soon as they entered in Samaria, Elisha said, "Oh, Yahweh, open the eyes of these men that they may see." So Yahweh opened their eyes and they saw, and behold, they were in the midst of Samaria. As soon as the king of Israel saw them, he said to Elisha, "My father, shall I strike them down? Shall I strike them down?" He answered, "You shall not strike them down. Would you strike down those whom you have taken captive with your sword and with your bow? Set bread and water before them that they may eat and drink and go to their master." So he prepared for them a great feast, and when they had eaten and drunk, he sent them away, and they went to their master, and the Syrians did not come again on raids into the land of Israel. How can we help atheists and agnostics? Be kind. Be kind, be hospitable, be nice, be loving, be gentle. Do not be arrogant. Kindness includes being humble and open-minded, being willing to listen, right? How many of us have someone in our life that we need that friend? Some of us have them, some of us don't. We're like, I'm still searching for this. Had that friend who, when we have a problem, we can call, and we know that they'll just let us talk and talk and talk because we say they're a good listener. You know who needs good listeners? Atheists and agnostics. Sometimes the atheists and agnostics, when they want to tell us something, we're so eager to try to give them the answer that we miss an opportunity to create that atmosphere of kindness that says, "Man, I'd never thought about that. I can tell you've thought a lot about this. You've really thought deeply. You've given this some thought." Instead, my tendency, here's been my simple tendency, they start to share. I'm not sure I can even wait for them to give the full 2-minute answer of why they object. I'm trying to interrupt it second 34 seconds. I can explain that first one. He may not be wanting an explanation at that moment, Coulter. He may need somebody to, for the first time in his life, just listen. Because a lot of times at 34 seconds, they haven't really gotten to the heart of the problem. They might not share that with you until the 34th minute or the 34th day of being a friend. Let me also suggest that we should search out conversion stories to see what converted them. And you'll see that it does vary widely on how people are converted. There's lots of different types of people that need to be converted. One I heard about a while ago was from Rosaria Butterfield. Rosaria Butterfield was a feminist, lesbian English professor. And so, you see there, the title of her book, The Secret Thoughts of an Unlikely Convert. Those are her own words. I can't believe he said that about English professors. My sister majored in English. Now, I'm not talking about your sister. This is what she said. She said, "I was an unlikely convert. A lot of people wouldn't have given me any time or attention. A lot of people wouldn't have even wanted to listen to what I had to say because of her personality, her approach to things, the way she talked about things." Let's be honest. Some of us are already, we see that label, a feminist, lesbian, English professor. Yeah, I'm not having coffee with that one. If that's what you would think, you're with her. She said, "I'm an unlikely convert." How was she converted? Hospitality. She visited a church. They were nice to her. Preacher invited her over for a meal, and she went. Hospitality. She later went on to write a book. She actually went on to marry that preacher, a man, to be clear. Married that preacher, and they wrote a book about hospitality, the lost art of discipleship making. There's others. Here's one of my favorites. I've been reading one of his books lately. You'll see why at the title. Why God Won't Go Away. Dr. Alistair McGrath, a molecular biophysics doctor over in the United Kingdom. And he's written a lot of books about faith and science and how they go together. I don't know if I've ever shared this here before, so I want to share this story because this is a great admonition for evangelism. Some people say, "I can't do evangelism. I don't know how to talk. I don't know how to teach. I don't know how to do any of that." Look at John chapter 1. John chapter 1, I love the story of these early disciples. The next day again, John was standing with two of his disciples, and he looked at Jesus as he walked by, and he said, "Behold, the Lamb of God the two disciples heard him say this, and they followed Jesus. Jesus turned and saw them following and said to them, "What are you seeking?" And they said to him, "Rabbi," which means teacher, "where are you staying?" He said to them, "Come and you will see." So they came and saw where he was staying, and they stayed with him that day, for it was about the 10th hour. One of the two who heard John speak and followed Jesus was Andrew, Simon Peter's brother. You ever want to know, how was Peter converted? Here we go. Andrew first found his own brother Simon and said to him, "We have found the Messiah," which means Christ. He brought him to Jesus. Jesus looked at him and said, "You are Simon, the son of John. You shall be called Cephas," which means Peter. It started with his brother saying, "I found something you need to see." Now, this is a delicate line here. I'm a fan of inviting people to meet Jesus. Sometimes we're eager to invite them to meet the church. There is an appropriate, right time and way that needs to happen. Obviously, I talked about earlier, we have attendance and membership issues. However, you need to think carefully about how you do this, because some people are not ready to go to church, but they are ready to come to Jesus. And at some point, then, it is important as truth tellers of the good news, the old-fashioned way is to say this: who is the church today? Well, who is the head of the church? Jesus. We're supposed to be the body of Christ. And so there is nothing wrong. It can be done in a wrong way. It can be done wrongly. But there is nothing absolutely wrong about inviting people to church if you view it as, I'm inviting people to the body of Christ. Not with a spirit of arrogance. Oh, you need to come to the one true church that I found over here. You need to just simply say, I have found some people who really try to follow Jesus with all their heart. They're not perfect, but they take Jesus seriously. He is the head of their life, and I want you to come check it out. Come and see. The next day, Jesus decided to go to Galilee. He found Philip and sent him, "Follow me." Now, Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. Philip found Nathanael and sent him, "We have found him of whom Moses and the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." Nathanael said to him, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" Philip said, "Come and see." Your only line to be evangelistic, your only line might need to simply be, "I have found something incredible among these people. They take Jesus seriously." And when the objector, cynical person says, "Yeah, right, I haven't met anybody that's taking it seriously," come and see. Just dare them. Here's what it was when I was a kid. When I was a kid, this is how we dared somebody, right? We said something, they didn't believe it, and yeah, the people before me said, "Double dog dare." This is what my generation did. Anybody remember this? Bet. I don't know. Anybody do that still today? Okay, yes. Oh, the young people too. I'm not so old-fashioned now. Dare them. Dare them to come give it a try. And tell them if you stick with it, you'll find a family of people who love you. Now, be careful throwing that around, right? Be careful throwing that bet around, because what we talked about earlier, sometimes churches can hurt people. So if we're going to go around telling people we need to come here, we got to be working together to create a culture of love. Not be the cynical person who sits off to the side and be like, "Yeah, this church is halfway devoted." You can be cynical all you want, but we're not going to become more devoted in your eyes until you join in with the devotion. So join in and make this a place that we can invite people to. I think some of the reasons people object is also because they believed other myths about church history, such as Hitler. Was Hitler a Christian? Some will say, "Hitler was a Christian. Surely Christianity can't create anything good." Well, Hitler hated Christian forgiveness. He wrote in his journal that he felt like Christian forgiveness and love made Germany weak. So what really happened is, I think he abused the Christians. He used Christians for his own agenda, because when you read his private writings, you can read, he has that journal I'm referring to, it's called Table Talk, and there's an English translation of Table Talk, where he said this: "The heaviest blow that ever struck humanity was the coming of Christianity." This is Hitler's words now in Table Talk. "The heaviest blow that ever struck humanity was the coming of Christianity. Science cannot lie. It is Christianity that's the liar." Some people are out there going, "Oh no, now he's brought..." Not only did he bring up Hitler, he brought up science. Well, Hitler did. Hitler brought up science. In 1935, the Nazis arrested 700 Protestant ministers because they opposed the Nazi Party for its racism, which, again, we've said before from this pulpit, and we'll say it again, totally a sinful, non-Christian attitude, racism. Several ministers died standing up to Hitler. One of those has become popular in America, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. So saying Christianity produced Hitler is not backed by the facts. It's another one of the myths that I've seen people in the book say they've run into. Another one is that Christians persecuted scientists. For example, Galileo. What actually happened with Galileo is that he betrayed a political donor. He had promised a cardinal of the Catholic Church and a pope of the Catholic Church that he was not going to bring up a certain argument. Then when he wrote a book that was making fun of the pope who was funding his research, not a good idea. If your sister is that English major who's getting funding from somebody, make sure she knows. Don't insult your funder. That's what Galileo did. He made fun of the pope in his writings, and so then the pope banished him from his funding, gave him house arrest. He did not torture him and kill him. And you can read more about this. It looks like the screen here has chopped this off by accident here. And it's in a book called Galileo Goes to Jail and Other Myths About Science and Religion. There's 25 academic essays in that book that discuss some of these myths of science and religion. So if that's your angle, if that's your relative's angle, if they love science, get them this book and say, let's talk. Now, let me give you a warning about this book on these 25 academic essays. It goes both ways. Some Christians have made some things up about science and religion that Christians should not be making up and should not be spreading because it's lies. And Christians aren't supposed to lie. So it's a very interesting book there talking about the myths from both sides that have been made up to make it look like science and faith are at war with one another, and they don't have to be. So be cautious handling history and science stories. Be an example of humility and open-mindedness, and perhaps this would help some of the people that you know in your life who love science more than they love Jesus. Einstein said this, and I think this is something for all of us to spend some time rightfully thinking about. He said, what separates me from the so-called atheist is a feeling of utter humility toward the unattainable secrets of the harmony of the cosmos. Humility. I think that's what a lot of people are looking for. The world is full of a lot of heroes who it looks as though they can't do anything wrong, or they're villains, depending on who you're talking to, right? Nobody's ever this mixture of good and bad. And here's something that we don't see in a whole lot of people: humility. We as Christians ought to be beacons of humility in the world around us. We ought to, like Einstein's referring to here, marvel at the cosmos of what God has given us to look at. Over the last couple of weeks, one of the things that was coming through on my social media feed is how NASA is constantly surprised and confused by the information they're getting back from their satellites that have headed into deep space. And these are the headlines. You maybe have seen some. I should have put some of them up here as an example because you may be saying, is that true? I'm not telling a lie. The headlines say, NASA saying, we don't understand why that satellite is sending back these signals. Maybe it's because we ought to have a whole lot more humility and not act as though our technology is perfect and can never fail. Humility. Colossians chapter 1, when Paul is writing about Christ, he says here that Christ is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation, for by him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things were created through him and for him, and he is before all things, and in him all things hold together, and he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent, for in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his Christ. I'll tell you who's not confused by the data that's coming back from deep space. It's Christ Jesus. Because he created the deep space. The black holes, the nebulas, the blue stars, the orange stars, all the planets, or as the old-fashioned people used to say, the heavenly bodies. And so may we hold him up as first and foremost in our life and encourage others to be thankful for the age we live in. We live in a day and age in which all these things are easy to find. The internet has blessed us in some ways, it's cursed us in others. The Institute for Creation Research, we have some of these even in our library downstairs. Videos that are all over YouTube. If you need an old-fashioned DVD, we got that in the library downstairs. We have Answers in Genesis, Stand the Reason, Reasonable Faith, and many, many more. I could list up here of these resources that are giving answers for why we believe this world was created by the Father and His Son, and that they have sent the Spirit to empower us for living in a way that is a display of His glory. And hopefully we'll have more of these on our own, northeastchurchofchrist.org. It'll grow over time in addition to what we have in the library. So these are some ways to answer some questions that people have. And I hope that that will equip you. I hope it will encourage you. And again, a lot of these lessons are on Sunday nights, but you can find them on our website where you can look up and take your own time to be able to empower yourself to give the reasons for why you believe and be equipped to listen to the emotions that are behind some of the skeptics in our life. Thank you for your time and attention, and I hope this lesson was helpful.